If you'd like to take your Bibles and turn to the book of John, chapter 21, we'll be studying this evening from verses 18 through 23. That will be our text of our study. Before we begin, I'd like to say that I'm very grateful and thankful to have been here this week. I've certainly been encouraged by it myself, and I thank you for that honor and privilege that you've extended to me to come and be with you. Thank you for your hospitality, having me in your home and sharing meals with me and my wife Ruth, and that's meant a lot to us as well. Your friendship and kindness are appreciated, and we love the brethren here. I'm grateful as well that Ruth has been able to come with me each night. Her work keeps her, you know, pretty busy, and she's worked things so she could come be with me. Ruth's my wife of 35 years. She's not only my wife, but she's my best friend, and I'm glad that we've been able to ride together and talk and coming and going, and we've certainly enjoyed it. It's just been a little over an hour, and we've kind of got used to the roads, you know, and coming up and down, and it's fun. We have, back in eastern Kentucky, kind of rode a circuit when I first started preaching, and so our daughters were raised on Sundays. We were going visiting somewhere preaching, and we would meet, and of course, during the afternoons, we would visit around wherever we was, and had just have a good time, and a good time coming home, and in the evening when it was all over, and we were heading back, we'd talk about things of the day, and it was just a joy, and we continue to do that as we're able to be about. The lesson that I want to share with you tonight is one that I actually prepared a couple weeks ago, and I presented to the brethren down in Lawton, and it was one I had intention of putting together and preaching here in this meeting. I thoroughly enjoyed the study of it. As more I looked at it, more things came out of it, and it was just of great value to me, and I thought that it might be something good for you as well. And so I'd like for us to look at this little text in John chapter 21 this evening in hopes of encouraging us in difficult times and troubles that might happen to us along the way. And keeping our focus and our goal on heaven and our love toward God the way that it should be with all of our heart as we walk through this life and encourage each other. I've entitled the lesson based on those verses 18 through 23, "What is that to you? You follow me." And of course, that is a statement that Jesus made to Peter in this chapter. I'd like to initially say, as we begin to look at this, to consider some thoughts, I'd like to present a verse to you by King Solomon when he said, "There is an evil I have seen under the sun, as an heir proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, while the rich sit in lowly place. I have seen servants on horses, while princes walk on the ground like servants." Now, he's speaking of things that are not normal or things that are upside down. And so, as we look at the world that we live in today, I'd say that most of us have seen this same kind of thing going on in their day and time, where that we may question and wonder about what's happening and why that we may be suffering the way that we are as we look at others and think about what's going on with them as well. And would you agree with me that some people, it seems, have it better, while others seem to have more trials and tribulations? On the way up this evening, Ruth was telling me that there was an assistant that came to help her at her work today. The normal crew in the kitchen was off, and she actually had it by herself. And so they actually had to bring someone from another school to assist her. And she was saying that it was a difficult school where this girl had come from. And she was telling her about a young boy who walked to school 7 miles a day and because he didn't have no transportation, had difficulty. And she said more about it and the poverty it seemed that he had in his life. And I asked her, I said, "Well, who is he? You know, what could we do?" And, you know, we begin to be concerned and troubled about things like this. And we see someone that actually the lady had went early one day and found him asleep on the steps where he'd come early to be sure he got there. And I just, you know, you begin to picture that person in your mind. And a young fellow who wanted to go to school and apparently in a difficult situation, not very much support. And a lot of young people find themselves in that situation today. maybe the meal that they have that day is the only one that they'll have at school. And so people struggle. And we wonder, why is it this way for this person and that way for that person? And it happens all around us. And it's something that troubles us sometimes. And if you've ever been troubled by the fact that at times life seems to be unfair, I think there's a lesson to be found here in this last conversation, or one of the last conversations that Jesus had with Peter. And that's recorded for us here in this text. And what we want to do is to lay the background for the text and draw the story out and look at it and think about it. Then we'll make some application at the end of it. And so I want to just talk to you about it as we go along. Now, initially, as we begin, the events of John chapter 1 beginning at verse 1. Now, initially, we would say too, and I want to point this out as well. When you think about the individual that we're discussing is Peter, we seem to have a lot of commonality with Peter. He was sometimes forward. He said things that got him in trouble. He did things that were sometimes got him in trouble as well. And people relate to him quite often. And we think about him and his life, the obstacles that he overcome. And to hear his name, Cephas, or a stone, or a rock, when you think about him. And actually, I think it's interesting, that little title that I had there, Follow Me, was one of the things that Jesus said, the last thing we have that Jesus says to Peter, but it was one of the first things he said to Peter as well, when he met him by the Sea of Galilee, Follow Me. And so, we see this journey that Peter goes on, and like many of us do in life, as we struggle sometimes in difficulties, as we grow and we learn, and as we come to understand things, as we meet different challenges in life. But at this point in time, we see that Peter had fallen away. He had, in fact, from Matthew's account, had denied the Lord three times, when in fact he said, if all forsake you, I won't do that. He would not forsake the Lord, even if others did. But he, in turn, did that very thing in a very shameful way. In fact, in Matthew's account, you have that he even cursed and denied that he knew Jesus. And Luke's account tells us that actually Jesus was close enough to where when he looked at it and he wept bitterly, calling to remembrance what he had done. Now, in John chapter 21, we're seeing Peter being restored. And his work set out for his commission and what he's to do as well, as well as the others from this too. I want to begin there. We'll notice that after these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. And this way he showed himself. And so John is laying out an event here where it comes to a discussion of Jesus and Peter at the end, as well as John. If you read through the text, you actually have Peter's name mentioned about 10 times. And then you have him referred to as him, as he spoke to him two times. And so he's a focal character here as well. Also, when you think, as you just do a casual reading of the book of John, I want you to notice that verse 30 and 31 of chapter 20, and many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing him might have life through his name. Now, some have concluded from that is that that seems to be the end of the book. And so what do we do with chapter 21? Another thing, you have that disciple whom Jesus loved referenced there all through the book, because John doesn't mention his name himself, but he speaks of himself as that disciple whom Jesus loved. But if you'll notice there in the end of chapter 21, this disciple which testified of these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. So that certainly raises a lot of attention of, okay, now how does this work out? When you look at John 21, was it a supplement to it? Was it something written later? And there are those who suggest that that's the case. I'd like to point out to you, though, first of all, that there's no known manuscript where that the book of John has been presented that ended in chapter 20. Chapter 21 was always there, and it's always a part of it. So there may be another answer to that. When you look at the miracles that Jesus performed in the book of John, the book of John is set out, if you notice, as the synoptics like Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the book of John is unique in the way that it is. And, of course, it's more the inner circle of the Jesus and his apostles and things that involve them. But there's a purpose for it, too, is that it's set out to show the deity of Jesus. And remember verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Verse 14, they took upon flesh and beheld him. And so Jesus came in the flesh. Now, to make his case, he builds that around seven miracles throughout the book of John. You have the changing the water into wine in John 2, the healing of the official son in Capernaum in John 4. You have the healing of the paralytic at Bethsaida in John 5. And the feeding of the 5,000 in chapter 6, Jesus walking on the water in the latter part of chapter 6, healing the man born blind in John chapter 9, and then, of course, raising of Lazarus in John chapter 11. Now, if we were to include the resurrection, that would be 8, and certainly a miraculous thing is done there, but that's the climax of it. You know, Jesus had the power. Jesus was the Son of God, and he rose from the dead. But everything, those seven miracles prove that those were signs to show that he was divine. He, in fact, was. In the resurrection, we see that God rose again from the third day. The death, burial, and resurrection is just like the other Gospels have to say, and detailed about that. Now, John chapter 21, think of another thing, too. Look at how all the other three Gospels end in a commission. Go into all the world and preach the Gospel. And, of course, the conversions that and the teaching that accompanies that to make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe all things that I've commanded you. And so that's Matthew's account. And Mark 16, go into all the world and preach the Gospel. In Luke 24, that teach repentance and remission of sins should be preached at Jerusalem. Now, Matthew and Mark, both of those focus on the events during the commission in Galilee. Luke, his focus is the events in Jerusalem. John is a little mixture of both. But chapter 21, restoring of Peter, and the work that they would involve in caring for the flock once these are established. Now, some have went too far with that of saying, okay, and the Catholicism takes John 21 as this is Peter's commission in the point that he is to shepherd or be the chief shepherd among the flock, and like the Pope, and he's the first Pope of Rome. That's not the case there. All of these got these teaching that was done there. But there were some particular things that had to do with Peter and with John. This text reveals something else, a discussion that Jesus had concerning John. If he tarry till I come, what is that to you? And how that they looked upon that this disciple would remain until Jesus returned again. Well, John clarifies that in John 21 and also speaks about the restoration of Peter and their work. And so I think as we look at that, we come to a better understanding of the purpose of John 21 and the placement and the way that it's laid out here in John 20 and 21. And it was something here that we find it's necessary. But also we see that this is the Sea of Tiberias or Galilee. And in this way he showed himself. And so John begins to roll out this story and how that this began to bring about Peter's repentance or his restoration and clarification of that concerning himself. Verse 2, we see that Simon Peter, Thomas, and called the twin, Nathanael of Cana of Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Now, we have here five disciples or apostles named, and we have two that are not. Now, Simon Peter, of course, and then here we have Thomas called the twin. Some have thought, well, does that mean that he has a twin brother? We don't know about that, but that's what that means. And then, of course, Nathanael of Cana of Galilee. Now, this information about where Nathanael is from is found only here. So that's a little bit more information about him. Then you have the sons of Zebedee. That would be James and John. the writer of the book, and his brother, and two other of his disciples. Now, some have alleged that this probably is Andrew and Philip. He mentioned them earlier. Why he would not mention them here, I don't know if that's the case. So I'm not sure, though that commentators suggest that that's who it is, I don't know that that's the case. It just says two disciples. But in total here we have seven. Now, John or Peter says something to them. Simon Peter said to them, "I'm going fishing." So they said to him, "We're going with you also." They went out and immediately got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. A couple things here, too, to consider. Peter had denied the Lord, and no doubt he was shameful of what he had done. You remember, we look at in Matthew, Mark, and Luke's account, when Jesus appeared to his apostles and gave the Great Commission, he rebuked them for their hardness and their unbelief. On the road to Emmaus, we have a conversation that Jesus had with them as well. And so the question comes up, why are these men going fishing? Follow me, become fishers of men. Now we're turning back to this. And is that the case here? We don't know entirely the whole idea about it. Could be that from Peter's point of view, maybe he didn't know anything else to do at this point. Now, we know also, as we read about Peter, that Jesus healed his mother-in-law, so it tells us that he was married, and that he was an elder, so that tells us he was married and had children. And so 1 Peter 5 points that out. So he had an obligation, responsibility to feed his family, and no doubt this would be a means to do that. Now, I'm going fishing, and then they have a boat here, so some conclude what's obvious, that probably since he was of that craft, that maybe the boat was his, and these others go along with him. Now, maybe this would include them as well, that they only did what they knew to do at this point in time. Peter, no doubt because of shame, but the others may be wondering now, about what's happening. Now, they had some evidence of some things, and as we saw in the last chapter, Thomas had doubted, in fact, until he was Jesus appeared to him again, that he might see his nail prints and stick his hand into his side, that to remove that doubt. But these we find out here fishing for whatever reason. And I think it's another little side note here. They fished all night and caught nothing. And I don't know that too much can be made out of that, but I just think it's interesting here. Without Jesus, they catch nothing. Verse 6, with Jesus, they can't hardly pull their nets up. And got a great catch of fish here. So we see some things that are taking place, and these men, what they're doing. Verse 4 tells us, but when the morning had now come, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. We have an old fisherman down in Lawton, and I did this lesson. He talks about fishing all the time. And if you fish much early in the morning, like a lot of fishermen do, and through the night and the morning, then of course you've got a mist or a fog. It's kind of hard to see. Now, a little later on, we find that these men were about 100 yards out, and they see someone here, but they didn't know who it was. They didn't know that it was Jesus. And so probably looking through the mist of the morning as this was going on. Now, when Jesus said to them, "Children, have you any food?" And they answered him, "No." Now, it might be, when you look at this word "children" here, it's not like saying, as some version maybe have this a little bit too loose, friends, like in a casual way, but I don't think that's the idea from the word. It's a little bit more endearing and truer and closer relationship than that. Children, when you think about a father and his son, children, as he speaks to them, but they answer him no, not knowing who he is. But it might be a first clue of who is on the shoreline asking about how that they're doing. Now, he said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you'll find some." So they cast, and now they were not able to draw it in because of the multitude of fish. Now here, we might be able to maybe see something different. Now, first of all, on the right side, modern times, we would say, well, that's the starboard side. And so you might think, well, you mean these guys fish all night on the left side of the boat? Not necessarily, but the point is that Jesus is there, and he says, "Cast your net off on the right side, and you'll catch some." Now, I think that's unique too, because they obey, and sure enough, this is what happens. But I wonder what might be going through their mind, that this sounds familiar. We'll go back and look at Luke chapter 5, because a very similar thing happens there. Some, in fact, say that this event and that event are the same, but there's too much involved in these two in placement of that would suggest that's not the case at all. These are two distinct, different situations in time. However, we see some similarities. Probably what I wanted to call attention to is by what's happening now, that who is this one standing on the shore? At this request, they obey. They don't rebel against that, and then they draw out this number of fish. And in verse 7, therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved, and so John's referencing himself there, said to Peter, "It is the Lord." Now, I think it's interesting, too, that both of these individuals are close friends. They had been together in an occupation, had been together as disciples, and they were close. And they both of them come into the picture later in this part of the chapter, too, and as it concludes itself. But here we find these two on this ship together, this little boat, and John acknowledged, "This is the Lord." Now, when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had removed it, and plunged into the sea. Now, I think the King James says that, for he was naked. I don't think that the conclusion of that is that he was totally naked, but probably had his outer garment off, so he'd be free to move about and work on the boat there as well. But rather than wait for the boat to come in, he puts on his coat and jumps out into the water. To go to be where Jesus is. Now, but the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from land, but about 200 cubits, that's about 100 yards, about a football length there, dragging the net with fish. And so here they come with the boat and with the fish. Might pause just for a second there on verse 8. And some have thought, well, okay, when they mentioned this little boat, that maybe they had a big boat and this little boat. I don't think that that's necessary, but the idea that you have this one that they were on, and they're dragging the boat and the net in as they come, but Peter's went ahead and left them, come on by himself. Then as soon as they had come to land, they saw a fire of coals there, and fish laid on it, and bread. And Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you have just caught." And so we find that 8 through verse 10 in the text there. Now, when you look at the fire, it seems that Jesus already has fish and he already has a fire. And for them to come and bring some of theirs too. So we see that Jesus performs this miracle in not a wasteful manner either. But also fishermen, as they share their meal together here, put some of yours on there. And possibly some have thought, well, maybe, you know, at this point too, maybe not enough. And so now that there would be more to be given here. Also, who built the fire? Who prepared the fish and all that? Some thought, well, maybe Peter was. He was already on the bank, and so maybe he did that while they were dragging it up. But I don't think that's necessary to conclude that. We're talking about Jesus. We're talking about the resurrected Lord here. And we can point out other places where God needed something done, and a miracle is not beyond his power to do. So everything's provided, and God provides, and here it is. And so we find that they have this meal there together. Simon Peter went up and dragged the net to land, so he goes and assists them in that, full of large fish, 153. And though there were so many, the net was not broken. And Jesus said to them, "Come and eat breakfast." Yet none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. Now, I don't know about you, but when I first read through that, I read through the chapter first, and I kind of noted some things that caught my attention. So I jot those down. Then I read through it again, and I see if those explain themselves just easily. And then I read through again, you know, and I think, okay, now these are some things I'm going to investigate about that. And this is one of them. Here we have a drought of fish pulled up, and but we have a number given to that fish. And so we have 153 fish. And so I asked myself, I wonder why John numbered that or gave that number. And many have. They said, okay, is this for some reason? Is it just face value that he mentions this? Was it related maybe to the fact that, well, you have this many fish, and the nets are not broken? How many was that? A whole bunch. Well, maybe you didn't have as many as you thought you had. But no, we had 153, you know, and a large fish. And so maybe that's just a simple explanation to it, probably the best one. But now there are those who go nuts with this, and they say, well, okay, now there's some symbolism in here. That's a symbolic number. Now, there's a host of ink that's spent on trying to figure that out, and there's a lot of things that people have said. Probably one of the most common ones is that it's the perfect number, 153. Because you have, it represents the Trinity too. You have three sets of 50 plus 3. And so you have that number, 153. Now, if you divide that, come up with the number 17. Symbolically, in the book of Revelation, you see that symbolism and numbers are very important there. And so 10 is a complete number. 7 is a complete number. So you have that connection to it. Some have alleged that that's the idea of it, and many others as well. But I think the simple explanation to be given was that you have such a number of fish caught, and the nets didn't break. 153 of them, in fact, was given. And, of course, we see the silence there as they shared this meal together. Jesus then came and took the bread and gave it to them, and likewise the fish. Now, this is the third time that Jesus showed himself to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. Now, there's another one of those places that I jotted down. Okay, three times. And so now I went to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and then John, and then I went to Acts chapter 1. I went to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, where Paul lays out quite a few verses there about those who witnessed Jesus, and last of all himself, he mentioned 500 brethren at one time. And so I tried to figure that out, of when this third time was, but all you got to do is just back up in chapter 20. And if you'll notice there that in verse 19, Jesus appeared to his disciples, and 8 days later, he appeared to Thomas. And then here, he appears to him again. And so we could not go any farther than the text and see that this is the third time. And another thing, too, is that it supports the idea, you know, of these chapters, this epilogue with the book. You know, it's not unusual when you look at John 21 as being an epilogue, because there is a prologue to the book, too. The first 18 verses of the book talk about Jesus and who he is. Then John begins to lay out then the story of what Jesus did. And so you have a prologue and an epilogue of this book. Now, as we look at this further, so when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus... Now, notice this, there's silence. Doesn't seem to be that anybody said anything. Nobody asked who Jesus was. So it seemed to be a silent type of thing. But now notice who, and if this is so, notice who speaks or what John says here. So when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of Jonah, you love me more than these." He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Now, I think many of us have looked over these verses where that Peter asked, or Jesus asked Peter this question not once, not twice, but three times. And this is the first one here. Now, some interesting things about this too. Simon, son of John, or Jonah, do you love me more than these? Now, there's three things to think about. What did Jesus mean when he said, "Do you love me more than these?" Was he saying, Peter, do you love me more than these men love me? Do you love me more than you love these men? Or do you love me more than these things? These fish, this boat, all these things of the world. And so those are the three thoughts that are given to maybe what was intended there by that. Now, another thing, too, is that Jesus uses a very high and beautiful word when he says, "Do you love me?" He uses the word agape. And that expresses God's love toward us. I think we understand the type of love that this is. It's for our well-being and our good, the kind of love that God has for us. Now, Jesus doesn't respond using, or Peter doesn't respond using that word. He in turn says, "You know that I love you." He used the word phileo. And that's, of course, where the city of Philadelphia, where we get our name, City of Brotherly Love. And that's a friendship, fellowship type of love that we have for one another. I love you. You're my brother or sister, you see. And so, yes, we have that agape love toward one another, but do we have friendship? Yes. I think it's interesting, too, that Titus in his letter, telling wives to love their husbands, he doesn't use the word agape, he uses the word phileo. I told you, my wife was my best friend. And she would say that I'm her best friend because we're close, and because we talk about things in her life and how important we are to each other. All the years we spent together, we're just no one can replace Ruth for me. She's my best friend, and so that's the way that Peter responds. That you are, yes, I love you. He said to him, "Feed my lambs." Verse 15. He said to him again the second time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" Again he used the word agape, and he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." He responds again using the word phileo. Now, I want you to notice too, as we think about that, look what Peter had done. Really, what kind of love did he have for Jesus? He had denied him. He had turned his back on him. He had cursed, saying, "I don't know him." Now, when Jesus said, "Do you love me?" Certainly not to that level. Peter, no doubt, would not reach that high. And so he responds, "I love you, friend." And so maybe it's showing his humility in this too. Now, we see some things happen by the third time. He said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Now, it's interesting now that Jesus this time doesn't use the word agape, but he uses the word phileo. Now, he asked Peter, "Are you my friend?" And then Peter responds, "You know." And no doubt he was troubled by this, as pointed out. I don't know all of what was going on in his mind as he was reasoning and thinking about what Jesus was asking him and what he had in fact done, even as a friend, what he had done to Jesus. And so he was troubled. "You know all things. You know I love you." Now, other things happen here as we see that Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." Now, I think it's interesting too that you have these terms given to Peter each time: feed my lambs, feed my sheep, and then, or feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my sheep. The Syriac version actually has feed my lambs, tend my sheep, feed my flock. Now, I don't know that there's no Greek text that backs that up. The Syriac version has that. And so some view it as that, as the little ones, and all, old, and then all together in that way. Now, I don't think that could be supported by three different words, but I think when you look at the word feed and tend and feed, it's the idea of pasture, care for, provide for, and nourish. So the same ideals are being expressed there as we look at this. Most assuredly, now notice what Jesus goes on to say now that this has been said. And this is going to lead into where we want to talk about here. "Most assuredly, I say to you, when you were younger, you girded yourself and walked where you wished. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will gird you and carry you where you do not wish." This he spoke, signifying by what death he would glorify God. As I was putting this together, working on it over a period of time, I called my mother and checked on her back in Eastern Kentucky, and we talked a little bit, and she said, What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm on my way home, you know." And I said, "I've been working on something." And I started talking to her about this. And I said, "I want to ask you a question." I said, "When Jesus said this to Peter, what did he mean by that?" And so I quoted it to her. And she said, Well, I think he was saying that, Peter, when you was young, you had strength to go around and do what you wanted to do, but as an old man, somebody's going to have to lead you about. And I said, you think that's what that meant? She said, yeah. I said, well,